So today's class, again, will be relatively brief comparatively, but don't count on that for next week because we have a lot of material to cover next week as well. And again, if you were planning to take the last week as vacation, probably not a good strategy. When the final will have, you know, a lot of the new material on it, and we only basically have 2 weeks worth of material, so that would be like half of it.
This week's review, is it also going to include next week's lecture?
Probably not. Probably not. Okay. All right, today we're going to be talking about depressants that don't include GABAergic substances, things like ethanol and anesthetics. As college students, you may or may not have had experience with ethanol. Many of you are still under the legal age in Texas, or at least some of you are under. There are various other constraints upon use of ethanol. Irrespective of form, when people typically are discussing ethanol, they're typically talking about one standard drink of ethanol. And that would typically be the equivalent of 1 ounce of an 80-proof beverage. So if it's a double, that would be 2 servings of alcohol, even though it's in one glass. If it's a triple or something, obviously you do the higher math. Okay. The problem with this sort of generic definition of a drink, when you purchase various forms of alcohol, they will all have various quantities contained within them. So different beers can range anywhere from, say, near beers, things that might be something like 2% alcohol, on up to about 12% alcohol. Distilled beverages, depending on the form you buy them in, if you get them as a mixed drink somewhere, it might be 10% total in the volume, or it might be closer to 100% in that volume. Things clear on up to Everclear, and in fact, the proof of different distilled beverages will be quite different if you read the labels. Even within a given category, you might get an 80-proof vodka, which would be 40% alcohol, or you might get a 180-proof, which would be 90% alcohol. Even more common in things like rum, with Southern Comfort. You know, any number of different beverages will have different contents. Even the same brand name may come in different proofs. You know, they might have a premium brand with a different colored label. It might have a higher, it might actually even have a lower content of alcohol. You're paying more for less in that particular sense. And the fact that something is called, for instance, light, does not necessarily mean it has a lower alcohol content. That typically is referring instead to the calories involved. And alcohol is just one contributor to the calories. Now, obviously, alcohol has a long history of social usage among humans. At one point in time, alcoholic beverages were probably safer to drink than water sources in many different communities. Most of them involved water, but they also had the ethanol to act as a disinfectant. And your chances of living longer might actually be higher if you consumed more alcohol. Not necessarily the case any longer. We typically now have better access to clean water sources, so alcohol these days represents more of a recreational beverage than one that protects health and safety. Now, of course, when we talk about alcohol, there are really a large number of different alcohols, and the only one that we tolerate well in our gastrointestinal system is ethanol. Now, I don't suggest you go out to Walgreens or CVS and buy some isopropyl alcohol and say, well, same thing. Not only will you cause yourself a great deal of gastrointestinal distress, but your liver will proceed to die on you rather rapidly as well. Your kidneys won't tolerate it well. Your nervous system won't tolerate it well either. Even though it's actually sweeter tasting, supposedly, So it might go down easier. Then again, there are plenty of sweet formulations of ethanol if that is your intent. Okay. Now, there's a lot of confusion over doses of alcohol and how your system deals with them, and the quantities that people can drink and get away with for different purposes. If they're not driving and not out in public, people can essentially consume any quantity they care to until they render themselves unconsciousness. Okay, once they reach unconsciousness, they may have some additional problems to deal with. But unfortunately, a lot of people consume alcohol using that sort of a system. Now, when you look at what happens to alcohol in your system, obviously the major route of ingestion is oral. So the highest concentration initially is in the gut, the GI system. Very rapidly, once it's taken out of the GI system, it goes through first-pass liver metabolism. So the highest concentration ends up in the portal vein serving the liver. Then the vena cava, and some of the other arterial systems, so that it can then be pumped through the rest of the body, then into other organ systems. So the initial concentration shows up being very high in the liver in associated circulation, then in arterial blood, then in peripheral veins. Which one gets tested if you're picked up for DWI? Peripheral veins. So that can often underreport what the actual alcohol concentration is in your system, particularly what is going to your brain. So field sobriety tests that are looking at behavioral effects probably give a more accurate portrayal of what's in the arterial system than a blood test itself. And many, many law enforcement agencies now rely on those field sobriety tests. In fact, you can initially refuse having blood samples collected. Eventually, you can't refuse it. But even then, if it's below the legal limit, they can still go by what your behavior was. Now, let's say a low dose of alcohol on this graph is the dose that it takes to get you to the legal limit for operating a motor vehicle in the state of Texas. For some people, that might be 2 beers. For some, it might be 4. But let's just use a number like 2. At that low dose, it would take a certain period of time for the 2 that have been ingested to hit the peak concentration. And then it will begin to be cleared from your system. Okay. So you will be at that peak for a relatively brief period of time. That's the period of time that you would be at risk for arrest if you're operating a vehicle. It's when you definitely need a designated driver. You'll still be under the influence of alcohol after that, but you'd be below the legal limit once the clearance had taken things back down from that peak. Now let's look at the dose twice that. Not 2 beers, but 4 beers. You actually get to the legal limit faster because you're ingesting more alcohol, but you get to the peak slower. And the peak ends up being more than twice, even though the dose was only twice, because clearance is involved in all of this. When you're clearing this half the dose at a fixed rate, you're clearing this higher dose at a fixed rate. So twice the dose, you're actually going to get to a higher peak at a later point in time. But look at this dotted line here. This is the legal limit. You're going to get above the legal limit sooner drinking more alcohol. And you're going to stay above the legal limit more than twice as long, considerably longer period of time. Even 1 beer additional will keep you above for not just half again as long, but perhaps twice as long. So when you're making the calculation, if you're consuming alcohol, and it's been a while since you drank, and how many beverages you consumed, most people tend to underestimate where they are on this curve. I know, well, it's been 2 hours since I last drank 16 beers. I should be fine now. In fact, they're sitting somewhere up here. It's gonna be, you know, another half a day or more before they're fine, and they'll probably be unconscious long before then. Police officers are fairly familiar with these sorts of curves. And when the person has been driving on the shoulder and then in the middle of the road and then the other side, or has been sitting in a stoplight with their turn signal on and has gone through several cycles, they have a pretty good idea where you might be on a curve like this. And their field sobriety tests are somewhat difficult for people to pass even in a sober state. And they're designed purposefully for that, so they can get people off the road before they kill themselves or someone else. So how do we get rid of alcohol in our system? This is a process that can occur in any cellular system. It can work in your brain. Basically, beginning with alcohol, it's acted upon by alcohol dehydrogenase. Alcohol dehydrogenase. And converted into a noxious intermediate, acetaldehyde. What have we talked about aldehydes before? Do they make you feel perfectly happy? No, they make you feel really bad. So the problem is, the first initial metabolic step produces something that your body does not tolerate well. So you're dependent upon the activity of this next enzyme in the system, which is a mitochondrial enzyme, aldehyde dehydrogenase. We've seen that in other metabolic pathways before. That takes that noxious intermediate and converts it into something that actually the mitochondria can use in the Krebs cycle, acetic acid. It can also be used for production of things like acetylcholine. So if you don't have sufficient activity of this enzyme, you're going to have lots of this noxious byproduct sitting around to be processed. You're going to feel very badly for a period of time. Obviously, the higher the dose of ethanol you take in, you don't immediately generate lots more enzyme 2 steps away. The longer you're going to have a burden of aldehydes around making you feel bad. This is probably the simplest of the metabolic breakdown pathways for ethanol. 2 enzymes. Please don't try and memorize this one. The liver typically does it more thoroughly, taking it not only to acetic acid, because it's not then trying to generate nutrients for other things, but breaking it down in the end to water and carbon dioxide. So yes, if you drink alcohol, you're contributing to global warming. The majority of the metabolism takes place in the liver. And unfortunately, one of the side effects of metabolism of alcohol in the liver is generation of free radicals. Free radicals can be harmful to any type of cell, including the liver itself. So individuals that consume large quantities of alcohol on a regular basis are potentially doing harm to their liver by generating large quantities of free radicals in the liver. They will circulate throughout the rest of the system, but since the liver sees them first, It essentially has first opportunity to be harmed. There are diseases like cirrhosis of the liver, various inflammatory disorders of other sorts that are directly correlated with this production of free radicals. Since the enzyme used for degradation of the aldehydes also plays a role in other metabolic pathways, there can be trade-offs that go on. So for instance, we talked about the degradation of catecholamines, like dopamine. And normally, if you went down this pathway, started with an MAO, you ended up with an aldehyde intermediate, which would have to be dealt with by this same enzyme, aldehyde dehydrogenase, to produce DOPAC, and then it could be acted upon by COMT and finish the metabolic breakdown. Now, what if you've consumed a lot of alcohol? The enzyme's got to deal with any aldehydes that come along. So you may end up with an abundance of this particular product, the dopaminergic aldehyde, and in an aqueous environment where you have plenty of water, like in your nervous system, you can end up with a condensation product which combines the dopamine, which was being broken down, with this aldehyde intermediate to yield a product like THP. Tetrahydropapaviriline, THP. This qualifies as an opioid in your nervous system. An opioid. We haven't talked about opiates yet. We'll be talking about those on Tuesday. Any guesses on what opioids do for your system? They act as analgesics. Analgesia means relieving pain. Okay. So one alternative to feeling bad because you've got too much aldehydes, particularly the aldehydes that are having to be dealt with from the alcohol intoxication, is to generate some opioids. Now, it doesn't feel so bad to have that hangover. Very often, that encourages people to drink some more. Because, gee, they really don't feel all that terrible. And, gee, they drunk an awful lot the night before. They should be feeling worse, and they don't. So it should be okay to keep drinking more. Anyone ever known anyone to do that? Perhaps more than a few of you do. The aldehydes are still there. Some of them are just being used to generate this THP. It's then much more complicated to metabolize that. And again, puts a lot of extra strain on the liver. But it's essentially the way the body's way of fooling you that everything's much better than it actually is. This problem is still there. All right, nothing on this slide should come as any surprise. Well, let's cover it anyway. Ethanol has multiple degrees of effects. Typically at low doses, if someone is, say, planning to drink a six-pack of something, but they've initially just started off with one or two, typically people don't drink six within 1 minute's time. The low dose actually acts as a stimulant, sometimes known as a social lubricant. It appears to lower cognitive inhibitions. One of the notable features that has been well known for about the prefrontal lobes of the human nervous system, which is a rather significant chunk of the human nervous system, they have larger prefrontal lobes than other species. So its output largely has an inhibitory effect on various behaviors. Only certain things are allowed by the prefrontal cortex. Alcohol is always an inhibitory substance. It always acts as an anesthetic to some degree. For whatever reason, and it's still not clear why, the prefrontal cortex seems to be particularly susceptible to its effects. So we inhibit the inhibition more strongly initially than the inhibitory effects on other centers of the nervous system. Inhibiting the inhibition allows us to do things that we would not normally do. Talk to people we might not normally approach, engage in behaviors that we might not normally engage in, get up in public and sing where we might not even normally whistle in front of anyone else. A wide variety of different sorts of things. Now, if people consume alcohol slowly, one beverage at a time over several hours' time, and then maybe another one over several hours' time, they might stay down in this dose range, where essentially then it acts as if it's being a stimulant by inhibiting these inhibitory functions. More typically, though, people will continue to drink at a steady rate, and they will get into this higher dose range, where now it's obvious that not only are the prefrontal lobes being depressed in their activity, but you're inhibiting activity throughout the nervous system. The most resistant portions of the nervous system to the effects of ethanol appear to be the life-supporting functions in the brain stem, ones that are critical for regulating things like heart rate, breathing, the emetic reflex. So it's usually a pretty good clear sign that you're getting into a very, very dangerous range when you're drinking alcohol and vomiting profusely. You're beginning to have major effects. You're in the dose range where you're affecting brainstem neurons very significantly. That should be a clear sign to stop ingesting alcohol. Unfortunately, socially, a number of people are taught that's the time to switch to a different form of alcohol. Not a wise decision. Vomiting does not remove most of that alcohol from your system. Vomiting indicates you have a very high level, at least in the arterial system, feeding the brain. You've passed the point where vomiting it back out is going to remove enough alcohol from your system. But at that point in time, people's cognitive function is not really functioning well enough to get that message through. Oh, well, I just drank 16 more beers, and there they are on the sidewalk. So I'm fine. I can drink 16 more. Or 10 more, since 16 was probably not a good idea. No. And then there's the effect of the aldehydes the next day, plus everything that the alcohol did, plus the fact that when most people are drinking alcohol, they think of that as a beverage. And if they're drinking that, why would they need any other beverage? So depending on the form they're drinking, they may often be dehydrated as well. Because alcohol will not serve the same solvent purpose in your body that water does. And again, as sober individuals right now, that makes perfect sense. But if we had been serving alcohol here for the last 2 hours, the sense of that might be a little over some people's heads. Some of that could be eliminated if there was like a social custom of people drinking an alcoholic beverage and then two glasses of water, something of that sort. That custom does not seem to have caught on, though. Not even two servings of alcohol in one glass of water. Yes?
Does the dehydration only occur because you're not drinking water, or is it also because the metabolizing the alcohol?
Well, because you're also trying to flush out the metabolites from your system, so you tend to be urinating more than typical. The kidney responds appropriately there to try to get the toxins out. So you're not only not taking in enough water, you're losing more than the normal amount of water. So you needed normally to make that deficit up. So it's on both ends. So as a consequence, most people don't feel extremely well after consuming large doses of ethanol. Now, individuals can train themselves by repeated exposure to tolerate that better, but they are still having some of those same effects. They just ignore it better at that point in time. Please don't try to write everything on this slide down. Again, none of these things should be of a surprise to anyone. That alcohol, for instance, is a sedative. It does, as we pointed out when we talked about GABA-A receptors, have an effect like benzodiazepines, like barbiturates, modulating and enhancing GABAergic function. We talked about the potential for generating endogenous opiates, making people feel better than they ought to, which then can encourage them to continue ingesting beyond what they rationally should. And since they're getting analgesic effects, well, everything seems to be okay. There is a very severe dependence liability. Alcohol is an addicting substance. Not everyone gets addicted quickly. Many people are more resistant to dependence of any particular substance. But if a person has a particular genetic profile where they're susceptible to any particular drug of abuse, alcohol is one that will work just as well as heroin or any other addictive drug. High doses, we see cholinergic effects, delirium, inability to distinguish what's really going on from what seems to be going on. Have you ever noticed someone that has consumed large quantities of alcohol and anything that is said to them makes them angry? Laughing, talking, saying their name, telling them calm down. Doesn't matter what's said, it could be misinterpreted. And their cognitive function is severely impaired at that point in time. Particularly higher cortical function. In fact, it's often the case that when people ingest large quantities of alcohol or ingest moderately high quantities on a regular basis, you will notice mood swings going on. We monitor levels of serotonin in particular. It appears to be enhanced. Long term, there are a number of different pathologies associated with high dose use of alcohol. Many different types of vitamin deficiencies, for instance, have been frequently noted. You might know the cerebellar issue that shows up with use of alcohol as a major nutrient. Korsakoff's, it also hits hypothalamus and various other areas. But the cerebellar effects are the ones that are easily noted because people stagger around, have trouble standing still, sitting, carrying out skilled behaviors. Liver disorders are a very common consequence, again, from the free radical damage. Problems with the gastrointestinal system, where it's difficult to tolerate large quantities of food. Well, if you're just only consuming alcohol, that may not be a problem. And also cardiac disease and other vascular problems. The mythology is that chronic alcoholics die of cirrhosis of the liver. Most of them, in fact, die of heart attacks or stroke.
What about the ones who don't die early at all?
That don't die early at all?
Okay, like my 92-year-old grandfather. Mm-hmm. Like,
how is he still, like,
healthy? How is he still alive? No, but considering his alcohol behavior, like, what about those type of people who seem like they're resistant to it?
Well, everybody has their own unique genetic profile, first of all. So he may produce more alcohol dehydrogenase than another individual. So he can actually deal with it. Typically, though, chronic alcoholics, people think they're drinking much more than they actually are. Because for chronic alcoholics, their ability to metabolize things is so impaired, a half of a drink may keep them intoxicated for 12, 15 hours because they can't even convert that into the aldehyde for that period of time. So they're dealing with pure alcohol on board for that long period of time. So sure, they are technically drunk, but they're actually not drinking that much any longer.
What about Keith Richards?
Definitely a special case. Not just alcohol and ingestion involved there either. Quite a dramatic change from him, what he looked like, say, as a 20-year-old, and a 30-year-old, and a 50-year-old. Well, he is about 70 years old now, but he looks like he's about 170.
Yeah.
One of the guitar players for the Rolling Stones. One of the living guitar players for the Rolling Stones, though. So with alcoholism, that's considered the addictive state. For addicts to alcohol, tolerance actually develops fairly rapidly. So early in the disorder, they can actually consume larger quantities than most people and appear to be cognitively intact. They're used to the fact that they're inhibited and that their inhibitory processes are inhibited. And in fact, plasticity allows them to compensate to some degree for that. They have perhaps learned not to drive, or at least many people learn not to do that. Unfortunately, not all do. It's easier just to stay in the bar, or stay at home. Dependence typically actually develops more slowly than tolerance. Remember, tolerance was that rightward shift in the dose-response curve, but dependence is the actual physical changes going on that then make you need alcohol on a regular basis so that you don't become ill. It's quite a bit more difficult to tell exactly what's going on with alcohol than with some of the drugs that are more specific to specific receptors in the nervous system, like, say, heroin or cocaine. But it does follow the same basic profile. The tolerance develops fairly rapidly, and dependence tends to develop more slowly. So someone that's drinking a lot and now not feeling the effects as much might continue to drink a lot till they get to the point where now they are dependent, they are addicted.
Do you think
So binge drinking can turn into daily drinking and then multiple times daily drinking because of this particular set of time courses. Francesca Philby, who was hired to our faculty down at the Center for Brain Health, gave a brown bag week before last. A few of you might have seen it, showing that alcohol dependence shares same or very similar neural mechanisms to dependence on any other addicting drug. In fact, it seems to share common mechanisms with eating disorders, at least overeating disorders. Same reward centers actually downregulate themselves, so they need to be stimulated more to achieve any level of happiness from intake of substances. Eventually, almost any addictive drug, and alcohol certainly fits this profile, individuals develop reverse tolerance. Instead of tolerance, it's sensitization. Instead of a rightward shift, a leftward shift in the dose response curve. And that appears to be mostly due to impaired metabolism. They're no longer clearing the drug as well. So the same dose now has more effect rather than less. So the tolerance appears to be slightly physiological, but more a plasticity mechanism, while this reverse tolerance is more readily explained by impaired metabolism of the substance. Because obviously alcohol doesn't just affect the brain, doesn't just affect the liver, but affects the entire system. The motor effects of alcohol are well known. Inability to steer an object driving 70 miles an hour as well as without a dose of alcohol. Cerebellar problems secondary to malnutrition that show up in Korsakoff's are an unusual event. But motor cortex is impaired and motor neurons are impaired in almost any individual using alcohol over a long period of time. Obviously, there are social issues related to alcohol. Is alcohol use encouraged or discouraged in the U.S.? I think the better answer is both. Yeah. We're a very schizophrenic country. We like to celebrate the Puritans at Thanksgiving and sort of discouraging anything fleshly. But the other 364 days of the year, many of those things are widely encouraged, particularly by advertising and the free markets, as we call them in the U.S. Not really free markets at all, because alcohol production is still subsidized by many governments. Same time, you know, we have socioeconomic outcasting of certain alcohol-related behaviors. But only certain ones and only in certain settings. We probably don't have wet t-shirt contests here in class, but alcohol is often associated with that in certain social settings. We don't encourage people here to have beer bongs on campus at the pub. But then again, people worked really hard for decades so that alcohol could be served at this thing that calls itself the pub, which was a pretty strange name up until that point in time. So we have a lot of sort of social schizophrenia related to ingestion of alcohol, the intoxicating effects, and then the possible consequences of those effects. Society helps define what we mean by terms like problem drinking. Is it a problem if someone drinks one beverage? Typically not. unless their social mores define that as forbidden. Is it a problem to consume 15 alcoholic beverages? There, it probably depends on the time period, whether the definition would consider that to be a problem or not. If that was over a two-week time, probably not. If that's within an hour's time, most people would define that as a problem. Unless you're in a fraternity, say, down at SMU. Then that might be the acceptable norm. Even what we define as binge drinking, you're drinking too much. That might have a different definition if it's a one-time event or it's a celebration of something, as opposed to if it's something that happens at random times or all the time. For many people, the definition of a party equates to consumption of alcohol or some other intoxicant, not necessarily one that is drunk. For others, that might never enter into the equation. So societal definitions certainly play a significant role in ingestion and the amount ingested and the regularity of ingestion. Problem is that with alcoholism, there are not really many good treatment strategies available. What's the most common one? AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you think the success rate is of AA? They won't post it because of their definition. It's anonymous. No one admits to who they are. They just admit to being an alcoholic. So there's no real data available. When people have taken post-exit surveys, though, of people leaving AA meetings that agreed to be non-anonymous, the data suggests that recidivism is over 80%. That means only 1 in 5 actually stop drinking, more or less. And even those 1 in 5 will admit to drinking occasionally to excess. Then they go back to AA meetings again. Most people drop out of AA.
Yeah.
So that typically shows they are getting worse. No one keeps track long term of things like death rate with alcoholism. Because do any of you identify yourself right now as an alcoholic? Are you ever asked to identify yourself as an alcoholic? When you register for class, do you have to check a box that says, I'm an alcoholic? No, so it's very hard to get real statistics on this.
That's true, but I believe in some doctor's offices now, they're asking you, like, how many, everyone's going to tell the truth. They ask how many alcoholics are in the
issues. Well, that assumes that you have a physician.
Yeah.
Okay. How many people in the state of Texas don't have any health coverage still? A large number, particularly at your age range right now. But really getting those kinds of numbers is very difficult. You know, we can get statistics like how many people were killed by drunk drivers, because there's a dead body there and you can sample their blood alcohol. And that is a frighteningly high statistic. Intoxication seems to play a major role in a large percentage of accidents of any sort. We know the social cost of alcoholic abuse is very high, but we don't know what it really is. It's undoubtedly underestimated. That's about all I can really say on that. Alcohol, of course, is a special case of anesthetic drugs. How many of you have gone in for a surgical procedure lately and had your doctor hold out a bottle of whiskey and say, here, drink this?
No.
Even in the state of Texas, things have changed. Typically now, volatile anesthetics are used if you need an involved procedure, local anesthetics, if it's done on an outpatient basis, but not even then. Some places, if you're going to have a tooth pulled, you might be given a general anesthetic. In all cases, the people administering those drugs should have an idea about the information shown on this slide, the depth of the anesthesia involved. When different anesthetic drugs are administered, typically a volatile anesthetic, there's several different pieces of information that the anesthesiologist, or if it's in a dentist office, the dentist or someone assisting the dentist should be paying attention to. One is your respiratory rate, how much are you breathing? Things related to your eyes, the movement of the eyes and the size of the pupils, perhaps even reflexes in the eyes. And then other things that are probably not as much closely monitored but are checked periodically, things that related to muscle tone in various other ways. When anesthesia starts, respiration typically is normal. Shallow depths of anesthesia, breathing doesn't change very much. Eyes will still track around, but the pupils will begin to dilate. That's the first sign that the drug is actually kicking in. Even though the lights can still be bright, the pupils will open up. Stage two of anesthesia, breathing begins to become rapid.
That's what that's supposed to mean, rapid.
The eyes are not moving around as much. The most notable feature that tells you that you've reached that next stage, besides the breathing change, the pupils are extremely dilated. Maximal dilation. You can still tap on the lid of the eye and the person will blink. But when you reach the next stage, breathing then slows back down. It looks more normal. The eyes stop tracking things very well, and the pupils begin to constrict. And the deeper you get within the useful plane of what is considered these three or four planes of surgical anesthesia, you can actually cut on someone and they won't complain about it. They won't jump off the table and run away. People begin to constrict more and more. By that point in time, mild stimulator would have evoked a response that's lost. Then you have to actually touch their eyeball to get them to blink. The eyeball is very sensitive, much more blinky than if you touch your eyelid. People can withstand more pain at that point in time. If you're doing a really simple procedure, that might be deep enough. If you're cutting through several layers of tissue, typically the anesthesiologist would take you deeper. Second plane. At this point in time, you're essentially unconscious. Your eyes aren't tracking anything. Pupils are getting very constricted. You're not even responding to people touching organs inside your body much at that point in time. Not normal stimuli at all. That's still probably not the right level of anesthesia for something like open heart surgery. I typically take people even deeper. And here's where things get tricky. And remember the eyes started off dilating? And they constrict, now they dilate again. That could mean they're waking up. But that literally means they're going deeper. Almost no response to any type of stimulus. Try really hard to get them to respond to any type of stimulus at that level of anesthesia. And look what's happening to respiration at these surgical planes. It's normal at that fairly shallow one, where simple procedures can be done. But as you go down from there, the breathing volume falls off tremendously. You still keep someone alive at this rate. push some extra oxygen in to the mix that they're breathing. It's really tough when they're getting down in this range. You're really not taking in enough exchange of gases to get rid of the CO2 that they're building up and take in enough oxygen. It's really tricky to keep someone alive. And if you're just watching their pupils, you think, oh no, we've got to give them more anesthesia. They're coming up. They're going to wake up and start screaming because their heart is in my hand. Part of the reason why anesthesiologists carry such high malpractice insurance, why the rate of drug addiction among anesthesiologists is higher than any other profession within medicine. Suicide rate is higher. Rate of divorce. Change in career paths. You don't find many 80-year-old anesthesiologists, or 70, or even 60. Most of them have changed to an easier specialty. It's very stressful. Because you can literally take a patient down to a point like this where they stop breathing. You're not paying attention to all the variables. Of course, they're monitoring EEG, they're monitoring muscle tone in various electrical ways as well. Perhaps stimulating nerves to see if they're still actually firing. If they mess up, you can probably bring a patient back, get their heart to start beating again, get them to start breathing again, maybe or maybe not breathing on their own. Because if they've been hypoxic too long, those brainstem neurons that regulate breathing may be dead. So they're going to have to survive on a ventilator for the rest of their life. If you've killed the brainstem neurons, what about the other neurons above that, that are more sensitive to hypoxia? Most likely they died well before the breathing control was lost. So the patient may technically survive, but they're really not the patient any longer. So how many of you, based on this chart, want to go out and be an anesthesiologist right now because you know enough to do it? You may still want to do it, but you better learn a lot more than you could find out from any single chart. Okay. So breathing changes go on. Reflexive changes go on. Changes in pupillary diameter. But they're not simple linear functions. They don't just go down and then go back up. They move in both directions at different depths. It's quite complex. Now, we've mentioned volatile anesthetics before. Early in the history of volatile anesthetics, substances like ether were used. That was the one that was first widely used about Civil War era. Problem was, it was explosive. Most of the time they were operating in tents, so ventilation at least wasn't as big a problem as in a hospital. But it had all sorts of toxic side effects as well. Chloroform was another popular one. Chloroform, unfortunately, rapidly puts people in very deep levels of anesthesia where they won't necessarily wake up again. One that's still used, for dental surgeries at least, because it only produces moderately deep anesthesia, is nitrous oxide, at least if you also provide oxygen. More commonly for surgical practices these days, drugs like isoflurane or enflurane, sibofluorane, same as this fluorane suffix, are used. Up until about 20 years ago, halothane was widely used. It's probably the most common volatile anesthetic. Not used anymore because it kills your liver. So people that had repeated surgeries would die of liver failure. There's another reason why there weren't old anesthesiologists, because they were breathing a certain percentage of halothane all the time, and they all died of liver failure too. These seem to be much less risky to your liver. So the fluorine drugs are the ones that are mostly used. Fluorinated hydrocarbons is another term. Fluorinated hydrocarbons. They have fluorine on their hydrocarbon structure. Relatively simple molecules, though. And they have to be if they're going to exist as gases. And they have to be something you can breathe in readily to be used as an anesthetic. How do you get them back out of your system? Do you metabolize them?
No.
You have to breathe them back out. So what's the problem if your breathing gets really depressed? It's hard to get the drug back out. Another problem, we don't have antidotes for these. We don't have antagonists for the mechanisms by which they work. So you literally have to keep the patient breathing and alive to clear the drug back out of the system. If you haven't, you're no longer an anesthesiologist. Well, depends on the hospital, I guess, and how much insurance you had. Many textbooks talk about the effects of anesthetics using a model like this, called the membrane fluidity model. It was basically admitting that they had no idea how anesthetics worked, so they made up a story. The thought was that you have normal cell membranes that contain all sorts of different transmembrane proteins, receptors, channels, all sorts of other proteins, enzymes. And that when you anesthetize, it disrupts the lipid structure and makes things more fluid. Things would start moving around. Problem with this theory is that would probably end up and disrupt most cells and kill them. It would certainly disrupt things like synapses, because all the components could just drift away. There was no evidence whatsoever for this being true at any range of dose of anesthetics that anyone would ever tolerate and live. It took really exceptional doses to get it even in artificial membranes. But that all the textbooks had this, mostly because we had not yet discovered this class of potassium channels. Tandem four potassium channels. Everybody remember those? Okay. They're not really voltage sensitive. They're not really calcium sensitive. We don't know any endogenous ligands that they respond to. They're very active down in the range where neurons like to live. Once they're turned on, they don't turn off quickly. So even if you turn off the anesthetic gas, you stay anesthetized for a while, even after it's cleared. And they're activated by volatile anesthetics. What did the tandem pore refer to? Two ion channels per protein. So we don't typically think of them as a receptor-mediated potassium channel. We're not exactly sure of how these anesthetic drugs interact with them. The presumption is that there's a binding event, but these drugs are so volatile, when you go to measure it, they go back off. Problem, again, for anesthesiologists is that we don't have any blockers for those channels. So you can't change the depth of anesthesia by putting another drug in. You can put something like adrenaline in to try to get the heart to beat faster, but that doesn't do anything to the nervous system. Not at the doses that you'd want to put and not blow the heart out, too. All right, so those are volatile anesthetics. We also have what are called dissociative anesthetics. Dissociative. They make you feel as if you're not there. Whatever is being done to someone else. They dissociate the perception and the pain from the individual. That includes drugs that are widely used still in veterinary practice. Drugs like ketamine. And the drug that was originally developed in that category we talked about before, PCP. PCP is no longer used by vets. It's too widely abused. When I started here at UTD, you could call up any of a dozen different vendors over the phone and order this drug. Now you have to have all sorts of licenses. You have to get it checked regularly. You have to keep track of every milligram of this drug you use. It has the same abuse potential as PCP. Took people a while to figure that out, though. High school students now recognize this drug has similar effects, dissociative anesthesia, dextromethorphan. Where's that drug found?
Cough syrup.
Cough syrup, NyQuil, wide range of different sources. Not complete anesthesia, I wouldn't suggest major surgery with any of these drugs, at least not for humans. But vets, they're willing to do it. The rat can't tell you afterwards what happened. It doesn't necessarily mean that the trauma did not occur, though. Probably not the right type of drugs to use if you're studying stress, for instance, or PTSD, or anything that might be influenced by those. That's why most of us these days use volatile anesthetics. Last one, oxygen. Of course, you know all the time, every time you take a breath, that's having an anesthetic effect on you, right? Wrong. Too high a concentrations of oxygen, though, can be an anesthetic. The Air Force and NASA found that out by accident back in the 1950s. Up to that point in time, they didn't fly high enough to need oxygen. Late in World War II, they started building bombers that could fly above 35,000 feet, and the crews passed out. So they had to provide oxygen to keep the pilots conscious. Well, the thinking was, a little oxygen is good, more oxygen is more good. That literally seemed to be the thinking. Not only was the grammar bad, but the thought was bad. Turns out that at concentrations, this is one atmosphere pressure, two, and so on, you get about three atmospheres of pressure, that's very toxic. After just a very short period of time, you begin to kill brain cells. Before that point in time, you render people unconscious. They were trying to keep them awake by providing oxygen. Instead, they were again passing out. And when they came back, they had major damage. Many of them died. Another reason why you don't want an unregulated tank of oxygen for scuba diving. Most people use a gas mix. Then you have other problems if you just use compressed air for scuba diving. So then you have the issue of nitrogen bubbles and things of that sort too. But even things like oxygen, besides the fact that they can cause fires, have other problems associated with them. That's enough for today.